everyone. It's your host, Kylie.
And Molly.
Now, Nevertheless She Existed is the feminist history party you've been waiting for. And we've had some pretty sweet guests through the years, including some amazing Black storytellers.
We stand in solidarity with Black Lives Matter. And in that spirit, we think it's really important to take time to celebrate those Black voices. So for the next few weeks, we'll be releasing mini episodes with stories of badass women from history as told by Black storytellers that have not yet made it to our podcast feed. On today's episode, we're featuring a story from one of our first ever live shows, The Celebration of Willie Hobbs Moore by Moya McTeer.
Moya McTeer is a New York-based astrophysicist who studies planets outside of our solar system. She's also a folklorist who specializes in using science and logic to build fictional worlds. You can hear all about the world she's built on her podcast, Exolore, where she invites experts to help her imagine life on a different alien planet in every episode. I was just a guest talking about art history and ladies' history with two very cool female scientists, and it was a blast, so keep an ear out for that. Now, Moya is an amazing storyteller, so buckle up. Here is the story of Willie Hobbs Moore.
Hi, how's everyone doing? Good, great. I have a life lesson for you. And that lesson is that it takes excellence to be the first. And this is for a few different reasons. One, you have to be excellent to break through barriers so that you're the first person there. Two, if you're not excellent, then the people who make decisions are a lot less likely to let other people follow in your footsteps. And in case you doubt that, I have a little example for you. How many of you have met someone and they introduce themselves and they're like, "Hi, my name's Dante." And in your head, you're thinking, "The only other Dante I know is an absolute asshole," right? And so you immediately like that person a little bit less. And that's the power of being the first, right? If the other Dante had been a really great guy, you'd have been like, "This Dante is also probably great." But he wasn't. So the second Dante's out of luck. I know this from personal experience. I've been the first to do a few things. I was the first person from my hometown to go to Harvard. Once I was there, I was the first person to study astronomy and folklore. I actually had to fight to let the university let me study both things as a major. And when I graduate from Columbia in 3 years, I'll be the first Black woman to get a PhD in astronomy from Columbia ever. Thank you. In 2021, which just seems pretty ridiculous. But it's one thing to be the first to do something in a place, to be like a conditional first, and it's something totally different to be the absolute first to do something ever, like the first with a capital F. So I started thinking, who was the first Black woman to get a PhD in physics or astronomy? And lucky for me, there's this really great list compiled of all of the Black women who have ever pursued degrees in astronomy and physics, terminal degrees, so PhDs. And I went through, it didn't take me very long, there are only 150 of us. So I went through the entire list and found the first person to get a PhD. And that's this person, Willie Hobbs Moore. She got her PhD from the University of Michigan in 1972, so this is her story. You might recognize another name on that list, Katherine Johnson, who featured heavily. She was, you know, the star of Hidden Figures, but she didn't get a PhD, so she doesn't count. Okay? Not here, anyway. Also, she's not forgotten, so she's not hidden anymore. She's been uncovered. Right, so we're talking about Willie Hobbs Moore. Willie was born in 1934 in Atlantic City in New Jersey, but then she started her career going to University of Michigan in 1954. So I wanted to set the scene for you, you know, take you back to the 50s. Dwight Eisenhower is your president, and Twitter doesn't exist, so you don't know what he's thinking at every moment of the day. This was the hit of the summer. It's called Little Things Mean a Lot. It's by Kitty Kaelin. And like, this is the song that people were jamming to. This is what pop music used to be. So like, just let that settle in a little bit. Every week, you were anxiously awaiting the new episode of I Love Lucy, which was in black and white because color TV wasn't really a thing until the 60s. Like, wasn't a common thing until the 60s. Bras were pointy. I don't know why. I don't know if it was because they thought it was stylish or comfortable, if it was just the limits of technology, but like, this is just what women wore. This is what you saw in stores and in fashion catalogs. And this last one is my favorite. Butter was its own food group. Yeah, there were seven food groups. There were things like green and yellow vegetables, meats, dairy products, and butter. this is what the 50s were like. This is what the 50s were like for most Americans, but Willie was black. And so that's not what her life was like. I mean, she also experienced those things. She knew who Kitty Kaelin and Lucy were, but she had other things to deal with too. So she grew up in Atlantic City, which was in the north, and so it was better than it would have been in most other parts of the country. And it also had a pretty big population of black people. So after the Civil War ended, there was a great migration to the north, where black people were freed from slavery, and so they were allowed to move about. And because Atlantic City is a coastal city, there were a lot of restaurants and hotels and other services where black people could get jobs as servants. And so a lot of black people ended up moving to Atlantic City. But Atlantic City was segregated, not necessarily by law, but it was de facto segregation because of a practice called redlining. Have any of you heard of redlining? Raise your hands. Okay, so for the people who don't know what redlining is, it was this practice in the 1940s where the Federal Housing Administration was giving out loans to veterans who were coming back from World War II. And they had these maps of the cities where they would say, you know, the green parts of this map are really safe, so we're going to give out a lot of loans for people to live in those areas. The red parts of these maps are dangerous, and we don't want to give out loans to the people who want to buy homes there. The problem, though, is that they decided a place was dangerous if it had a lot of black people in it. So what ended up happening was that all of the black people could only afford homes in these dangerous redlined areas. And so that became the black neighborhood of Atlantic City. It was in the north side of the city. And so that's where Willie grew up. The entertainment of the city was also segregated. So it's a coastal city. There's a lot of beach, and that's what people like to do for fun. But there was only a small section of the beach there where black people could go. It was like 2 miles out of the entire beach where black people were allowed. And if they stepped out of line, they were pushed back into their area. So, you know, the housing, the entertainment, those are all segregated, as well as schooling. So I told you the year is 1954. That's the year that the Supreme Court made their groundbreaking decision in Brown v. Board of Education that segregation in education was not constitutional. So this was when they officially decided to integrate schools. So up until now, Willie has been going to schools with only black kids. So she was really one of the last black people who had to go to school, like never encountering a white person, which is important because in 1954, Willie is about to go to University of Michigan, like the state school of one of the whitest states in America. And so while her white classmates are learning normal college things like time management and geometry and like how to nurse a hangover, Willie is learning all of those things, but she's also learning how to deal with white people, which is tricky, right? She does live with other white people because she lives in a University of Michigan dorm, and a few years before she got there, the university decided that black people could, in fact, live in the dorms, but they were segregated too. She only got assigned black roommates. But while she was there, she decided to study electrical engineering. She got not one, but 2 degrees in electrical engineering. She got a bachelor's and then a master's. She got her master's in 1961. For the next 5 years, she worked in industry as a professional electrical engineer. And I couldn't find reasons, like written down reasons of why she decided to study engineering. But I like to think it's because Willie was the first person in her family to go to college. And when you are the first person in your family to go to college and you come from a poor family, there are really only a few acceptable professions, right? It's like doctor, lawyer, in this time, engineer, because technology was booming. And so I imagine that Willie's parents were like, you're going to study one of these 3 things because you need to make money to support our family. So that's what she did. So she worked as a professional engineer. During this time, she also like met a dude, got married, had kids, whatever. But then she went back to school. She got back to school and she got the PhD. In 1972, she wrote a thesis on studying the ways that molecules called secondary chlorides vibrate. And I didn't read her thesis, so I can't tell you all about that. But that's not the point of this talk anyway, so it's fine. After she graduated, her PhD thesis advisor was so impressed that he invited her to stay, and he offered to pay her as a postdoc for another 5 years. So she did that and published 30 papers. There's supposed to be a little times 30 there. She published more than 30 papers in 5 years, which is, even by today's standards, like absolutely incredible. The most accomplished tenured professors these days will publish maybe like, I don't know, 3 first author papers in a year. She published like 6 or 7. She did so much. So she was really impressive. And that's like as a Black woman that she did that. So I'm just in awe. And then she decided to leave academia because she wasn't getting paid to do it anymore after her postdoc ran out. So she went to work as a professional engineer again. She got a job working on the assembly line for Ford Motor Company, and she worked her way up through the ranks to become an executive. So in 1991, Ebony, which is like a really popular Black magazine, in case you're not familiar, named her one of the 100 most promising Black women in corporate America. While she was there, she did a lot of amazing things. She really improved the productivity of the Ford Motor Company. So she was a really big deal there. She died in 1994 from cancer. She died, surrounded by like loved ones peacefully in her home. I've given you this life lesson that you have to be excellent to be the first, and I don't think there's any doubt that she was excellent. And when you do this, you leave a legacy. So she had a daughter who is now a practicing doctor in Michigan. So she went from being a first-generation college student to having a daughter who's a doctor, who's like saving people's lives. She increased the productivity of Ford Motor Company while she was working there as an executive by, encouraging them to adopt Japanese methods in their assembly line because they were a lot more efficient and productive. And I think this is the most important thing. This is why I decided to talk about her. She really opened the gates for Black women to get PhDs in physics and astronomy. So this picture was taken in 2015 at the National Society of Black Physicists meeting. I was there. And this is a picture of all of the living Black women who couldn't make it to this meeting who have PhDs in physics or astronomy. And that's it. I told you that there are 150 of us. And just for reference, like 800 white dudes got PhDs in physics last year alone. So since 1972, 150 Black women have done something that nearly 1,000 white dudes did last year. So the numbers aren't okay, but I think we really need to thank Willie for leading the way, because without her, I mean, that number would have been even lower. I have no idea who the next person would have been if it hadn't been for her. So if you could all raise your glasses to Willie, I'd like to give her a little toast. So thank you, Willie. All right, cool.
That was Moya McTeer celebrating Willie Hobbs Moore. One of my favorite things about this show is these connections, these threads of history through legacy. The fact that Moya is joining a long line of Black female physics PhDs that begins with Willie. And we're going to sign off before Kylie starts crying.
So beautiful.
But before we do that, we want to ask that you please consider donating to Moya's Patreon. And we're going to have that link in our description to her Patreon.
Moya has also asked for donations to be directed to the Loveland Foundation, a fantastic organization that helps Black women and girls get access to therapy and mental health care. The link for that will also be in our description. So cheers, everyone. Take care of yourselves and each other, and be nice to animals, especially the lady ones.
Hey, y'all. If you love this show and want to support us, please tell your friends. The more people who listen, the more we get to do this. And if you're near New York City at all, bring them to our live show.
Nevertheless, She Existed is a production of Caveat Media. It's produced by me, Kylie Holloway, and edited by Paula Pickering. Our executive producers are Kate Downey and Ben Lilly. Head to caveat.nyc for live shows, and coming soon, more podcasts.
And if you like this podcast, please remember to hit that subscribe button and rate and review.
Subscribe!